All around us, we are surrounded by wonder, if we choose to see it. Thursday night, I drove home from a late meeting here to my home in St. Louis as a thunderstorm danced at the edges of the sky all around me. The flashes lit the horizon, throwing the massive canopy of clouds into inky black relief. Just over the bridge into Missouri, I pulled my car over to the side of the road to sit and watch the show. No creative genius employed by the Dream Factory could produce such a display. And wonder can have a darker side. Rarely are things as idyllic as we'd like to imagine them to be. Thunderstorms that light up the night sky can also blow down trees and damage homes. Fields of flowers carry pollen and bugs and things that itch. A handful of sand is a magnificent, magical thing to examine under a magnifying glass, but even a few grains of that same beautiful sand in your sandwich can diminish the pleasure of your beach picnic. In our modern world of high technology, 24-hour news cycles, and all the answers of life's questions accessible in the smartphone in our pockets, our instinct is often to seek simplicity, as Thoreau did, and head into the woods to live simply, and view the wonders of the world through lenses unstained by modern contrivances. Many of us treasure those familiar lines from Henry David Thoreau's Walden. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I come to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world. Or, if it were sublime, to know it by experience and to be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. We treasure those words. Many of us know them by heart and can recite them, often with a wistful longing for a simpler, Spartan-like lifestyle of our own. And yet there are some things we ought to know about Thoreau and his life when he wrote those lines. Henry David Thoreau was an overeducated, underemployed friend of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Unable to find work to his liking, he made a subsistence living doing odd jobs and tutoring the Emerson children in the early suburbs outside of Boston. He did retreat eventually to the cabin he built for himself at the edge of Walden Pond, but his life was not nearly as Spartan-like as he tends to describe. He was a regular visitor for Sunday dinner at the Emerson's table, where he ate voraciously and took back provisions to his cabin each week, including pie. His mother did his laundry so that he could live simply and write essays in the woods. The rest of Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience and his time at Walden carries a tone of haughty superiority as he judged harshly those who chose to live in comfortable homes, purchase goods at the local market, and participate in civil society. His affected asceticism rendered him, in his mind, superior as a moral being to others. For all his descriptions of appreciating the simple wonders of nature and humble living, he was really kind of a pompous jerk. And yet, Thoreau's description of the natural world inspired generations of transcendentalists and changed the shape of theology in America. Now, I grew up in New England. I know Walden. Where I grew up, nature's most powerful brute efforts were often on display during late summer hurricanes that travel up the eastern seaboard, or, my favorite, their nastier winter cousins, the nor'easter. Nor'easters, for those who are not familiar with the term, are snowstorms that move generally from west to east and from south to north, sometimes coming across the Midwest or the Great Lakes, and sometimes coming up from the tropics along the eastern seaboard. Sometimes they come across the Appalachian Hills. They always, always end up in Maine and the Canadian Maritime provinces of New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island. The storms move north by east, yes, but they swirl in a counterclockwise direction like a hurricane. So they spin out over the sea and pick up moisture, and then return over the land and give it back with enthusiasm and vigor. So the storms move northeast, but the wind from them also comes out of the northeast, so it is chilled when it arrives. When I lived in Bar Harbor, Maine for several years, I experienced the brutal wonder that is a nor'easter headed towards the Maritimes. For those who don't know, Bar Harbor is actually on an island on the coast of Maine. There's a bridge, but it's still an island. And Bar Harbor is interspersed. It is has very porous boundaries with Acadia National Park, which is a magnificent place. So when the wind comes screaming in off Frenchman's Bay, laden with snow and sleet and freezing rain, and ice pellets hit your face, and the snow drives against the windows of the house, and it goes ting, 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 ting on the windows, on the glass. It is a beautiful phenomenon, best observed from the warmer side of that glass. Sometimes at the height of a storm, driven more by wonder than common sense, I would drive my old truck down to a place called Seawall in Southwest Harbor to watch the ocean pound against the rocky shore. Not all oceanfront property is sandy beach. In Maine, there are almost 3,500 miles of coastline with inlets, outlets, peninsulas, and coastal islands. Of those 3,500 miles of coastline, 12 have sand. The rest are made up of rocks of various size and stubbornness. As the wind churns up the waves ahead of the driving snow, the surf turns green and white, and this froth that looks like water in a washing machine on the agitate cycle. The waves crash together and fall apart, and they create giant peaks of spray and deep troughs of this gray-green cold from which no air-breathing thing could ever emerge alive. Ducks and gulls and waterfowl days earlier retreat to the sheltered waters of inland bays and rivers, occasionally taking residence in the high school football field. They tuck safely into the bushes and fields along the shore until the storm abates. I remember one storm when I drove along the Park Loop Road in Acadia National Park. The road, in the wintertime, there's no gate fee, so the locals can go anywhere we wanted in the park without having to pay the $20. So this road is high above the normal high tide mark, which is some 60, and it's like 60 or 70 feet up a granite cliff. And then back from the edge of that cliff, probably another 60 or 70 feet, that's where the road is. And the ocean that day was higher than I've ever seen it. We learned on the coast that with a full moon, the tide comes up higher. than it does at other times of the month. And so I have a feeling that it might have been a full moon and a storm surge. And so the ocean was right up to the edge of that cliff. And I rolled down, all right, this wasn't smart. I rolled down the window of my truck to smell the salt air. And I got hit in the face with spray. The next day, the inside of the passenger window was streaked with salt. There is something about nature that reduces us to a more humble state than we often care to admit. We like to think that we are in charge of things, important things even, but when a storm hits, when the wind blows and the waters rise, we gain a renewed clarity about the true extent of our power in this world. Now, I am a professional cynic. Before I ever considered ministry as a calling, and I still wonder some days, I worked as a newspaper reporter and as a political hack. I covered police reports and court cases and political races and small town politics, where I saw some of the meanest and most petty behavior I have ever seen from adults who are not related to one another by blood or marriage. As a political activist, I made phone calls, got death threats, fought against groups designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center as hate groups, and got prayed at and spit upon by people who declared themselves to be upright, church-going Christians. At one point in my younger years, I worked as a case aide for Maine's Bureau of Child Protective Services. In that job, I supervised visits between foster children and their families of origin, families that had treated their children in such a way that the state of Maine determined that the children had a better chance of surviving, not thriving, but surviving, if the kids were in foster care. It was my job to monitor the visits so that the parents did not pressure the children not to testify in court, or so that the parents would not beat or otherwise abuse the children during the visit. I have seen some of the very worst that people can be to one another. I know the depths of cruelty people will visit upon their closest family members. I have seen hate in the eyes of parents, and anguish on the faces of children. And yet we live in a beautiful world. Wonder remains. Miracles happen. People are brave in remarkable ways. A glimmer flashed across my news feed this week when I learned that Colin Kaepernick, who's here, a football fan? Thank you, Kaepernick. He's the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. I'm a Patriots fan, I don't really care. But what he did was amazing. He refused to stand for the national anthem during a preseason game. And it's not the first time he's done it, although this week is the first time he made the news about it. He refused to stand, and he issued a statement when asked about it. He said, "I refuse to stand to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color." The world is still beautiful, despite or perhaps because of its imperfections. Certainly the quarterback of a National Football League team lives in a world of some pretty rarefied privilege. But Kaepernick is willing to risk his own comfort to raise awareness of the oppression of others. And that is grace. I think we are too quick to dismiss an author when we learn that they have feet of clay. Thoreau was kind of a jerk, but his observations of the natural world and his transcendent experiences were not rendered invalid because of his character flaws. None of us is defined entirely by the best or worst thing we've ever done. We are complex, complicated people, We have inherent worth and dignity, yes, and we are imperfect enough that we need to be reminded sometimes that we have inherent worth and dignity. We need to be reminded that others have worth and dignity as well, that even the meanest among us is worthy of the love of the divine, and that all are deserving of mercy and grace. And it is there in the roots and foundations of our universalist heritage, that is where I find the wonder that can overpower my skepticism, because I am a skeptic. This unlikely, unruly, perhaps ill-advised, bone-deep belief, this knowledge that all people have some good in them, no matter what, for me, I found wonder in the natural world and in the resiliency of the human spirit and its capacity for grace. Our world is a complex place filled with complex humans. To engage in wonder in such a world is a spiritual practice of its own. It takes intention, patience, and a willingness to offer grace to the imperfect world, and to each other, and to ourselves. May we remember to do that today. May we remember to do that tomorrow. May we remember to do that every day. That is my prayer. May it be so. Blessed be.